Hello and welcome back to the Wrestling Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Frank Ebersold, and this is episode 49. Who would have thought? My God. Wow. Well, we're happy that you're here, actually, and we want you to tell your friends about us, and they can find us at www.rustedculture.com. That's all they need to know. They'll get right here. Well, we've got a lot of stuff going on this week. We've had Senator Dianne Feinstein kind of at the top of the news here this week. And as always, we're going to start this off with the Russian investigation developments, of which there are many. My gosh. Oh, wow. Takes more and more time to kind of wade through some of this stuff, folks. But let's kick it off here. So we've had Senator Dianne Feinstein, who the more I get to know through all of this, the more I actually like. Actually, you know, and I said that kind of about Senator Lindsey Graham a little bit last episode, didn't I? Well, I'm divorcing Senator Lindsey Graham. No more. Done. I'm going to call him Flipper. He's just too much over, you know, he's here, he's there, he's for Trump, he's against Trump. I'm divorcing Senator Lindsey Graham. We might make up. He might become the moderate Republican that I think he is at some point. Maybe we'll patch things up. But anyway, Senator Dianne Feinstein. So what did she do this week? She's done a lot of stuff. She's been very busy. And recently, she just asked two officials with the Trump campaign to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee as part of the committee's ongoing probe into the Russian meddling in the 2016 election. And Senator Feinstein, who is the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, has just sent letters to Dan Scavino and Brad Parscale last Wednesday, and she wants them to turn over all the documents related to the hacked emails from Democratic officials by Russia and their attempts to use social media to target voters. So who are these people? Well, Dan Scavino oversaw the social media for Trump's presidential campaign and currently is the director of social media at the White House. And Brad Parscale, well, for his bit, he worked as the Trump campaign's digital director. And Senator Feinstein is asking both of these fellows to testify. And did you know that Dan Scavino, once upon a time, when Donald Trump had time to play golf, and I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek because he plays a hell of a lot of golf today, but back in the day, he actually played more golf. And in those days, Dan Scavino was also Donald Trump's caddy. I thought he surrounded himself with the ultra-uber-rich. Well, here's an example. He must have liked what he saw in Dan Scavino because he went from caddy to the director of social media. Interesting how that works. But one of the things that Brad Parscale said this week, he tweeted something on January 5th, and I'm quoting, "Truth. Jared Kushner and Eric Trump were joint deputy campaign managers to Donald Trump. Nobody else. Not one person made a decision without their approval. Others just took credit for this family's amazing ability. I'm done with all these lies. They will be embarrassed." End quote. So, Brad, I gotta tell you, I mean, when you say stuff like that, it's no wonder that Senator Dianne Feinstein would like to have a chat with you. Because, you know, in my view here, does that mean that Flynn, Manafort, Papadopoulos, and Carter Page, were they all operating under Jared and Eric? Kind of sounds like it, doesn't it? And that would certainly be good fodder for Dianne Feinstein when she interviews them. And that could be really problematic for Jared and Eric because it sets up that chain of command. It verifies it. And on Tuesday, we had a revelation. Senator Feinstein just took matters into her own hands. Let's cue the angels. Hallelujah. She took matters into her own hands and she pried those transcripts of Glenn Simpson out of Grassley's hands. I can just imagine the tug of war. Give me him. Well, she pried him out of his death grip, and she released those Glenn Simpson Fusion GPS testimony transcripts, which we are now reviewing. And one interesting claim that was made on Rachel Maddow's show last night was somebody actually has already lost their life as a result of this dossier, which is kind of scary, folks. But there's 312 pages in there to review. And here's why I think Senator Grassley may have wanted to keep these transcripts private. And just in my cursory review, you know, this is what I do for fun, by the way, right? Just to let you know how interesting things are around here. One of the things that I read, and I forget what page it's on, but it's all out there. You can read through these as well. There was an August 1st, 2017 news briefing in the White House done by Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And she said that the Democrat-linked firm Fusion GPS actually took money from the Russian government while it created the phony dossier that's been the basis for all the Russia scandal fake news. And they asked Glenn Simpson, what is your response to that statement? And he said, it's not true. And they said, well, what in particular is not true about that statement that Sarah Huckabee Sanders made? And Glenn said, well, it's a false allegation leveled by William Browder before this committee and in other places for the purpose of his advantage. She's repeating an allegation that was aired before this committee and in other places that we were working for the Russian government, and it's not true. Most importantly, the allegation we were working for the Russian government then or ever is simply not true. I don't know what to say. It's political rhetoric to call the dossier phony. The memos are field reports of real interviews that Chris Steele's network conducted, and there's nothing phony about it. We can argue about what's prudent and what's not, but it's a fabrication. And one of the things that they did in this testimony, and Glenn went to the Senate Judiciary Committee on his own free will, and he gave a voluntary interview. But one of the things they tried to do throughout this whole thing was really try to tag him with a party affiliation. You know, they wanted to find out if he had an axe to grind. You know, was he working with a Democratic bias? And I have to tell you that Mr. Simpson is, you know, a former writer for the Wall Street Journal. And at one point, he did investigate Senator Obama's campaign in 2008 when he was working for the Wall Street Journal. And he tells about how he wrote an article that caused the Obama campaign chair to resign back in 2008. So the record is replete, he says, or the public report of my work is replete with examples of investigations I've done of Democrats that resulted in them losing their elections and being prosecuted. So, folks, I just want you to know that if they're trying to pin this guy, Glenn Simpson, down for being an agent of the Democrats, it's not going to work. He's clearly nonpartisan. I think he's a high-quality journalist. That's his background. He comes through as extremely honest and forthright with his answers. And some of them are quite interesting, but when you read this in that context, you get a feel for how Glenn operates, and you know, the character of the guy. And I think that's solid. It's good. And one of the things that Glenn did when he operated, as he operates with Fusion GPS, is that they seek the public record for all things when they're investigating first. They seek what's out there publicly. For example, he read every book on Trump. He and his team, they looked at the public record. They saw the taxes that were paid at golf courses. And one of the interesting things that he remarked about is that Donald Trump, in his opinion, underinflates the value of his golf courses. And that's according to Glenn Simpson. He, in his opinion, one of the things that Donald Trump does time and time again is that he underestimates the value of the golf courses that he has, which actually lowers his basis. Of course, when he talks to the media, the tendency is to inflate. So there's a deflation, and that happens when he's obviously reporting things for tax purposes, and then there's an inflation when he's speaking to the media. But specifically, in these transcripts, you can see that the tendency, or Glenn Simpson's idea of what Donald Trump does, is he underinflates the value. But getting back to what he does, so Glenn Simpson has also tracked Trump's travels to Russia. He's looking at the public record. They're looking at social networks, how people are linked together in the Trump constellation, I guess you would call it, of friends and that kind of thing. So this is what he does. And then they have people on the ground. They utilize Christopher Steele, who actually has a network of people that he retains. And these people, he asked them, I believe, for information, you know, put your antennas out, see what you can get on a lot of different subjects. And this is kind of what was coming in. But no, they didn't specifically go and say, I'll pay you, you know, $10,000 if you get this, or I'll pay you $5,000 if you get that. Christopher Steele, who was commissioned by Fusion GPS, more or less had this network out there, and he just put his feelers out and said, this is evidently what I'm looking for, and let me know what you guys come up with along the lines of this. So it wasn't information that was motivated on a singular basis by a dollar payment. If you can get this, I'll give you that. No, it's top-notch stuff here. I can see why Glenn wanted this release, because there's been so much misinformation about the guy. It's a mischaracterization, really. But, you know, the one thing that I have to tell you, folks, in reading through these transcripts, the one thing that bothered Glenn Simpson a lot was his understanding of Trump's ties to crime figures. And according to Glenn Simpson, that was sort of disqualifying in his mind about Donald Trump, his ties to crime figures. And I'm going to read you a little bit of stuff here. And Glenn Simpson says, or the question was, in particular, one of the things that you had mentioned, well, you had just mentioned right now, as we were speaking, the term illicit activity. What, if any, research did you conduct that gave you concerns about then-candidate Trump and potential illicit activity? And Glenn answers, and he says, I think the thing I cited to you was his relationship with organized crime figures, and that was a concern. And what can you share with us about those findings, your findings, they're saying to Glenn. And he says, well, I've tried to share as much as I could think of over the course of today. As I say, there were various allegations of fraudulent business practices or dishonest business practices or connections with organized crime figures. In fact, you know, there were numerous others that I can't remember the names of. It was a long history of associations with people accused of involvement in criminal activity. So in his mind, and that's coming from page 294 of this transcript, in his mind, Glenn Simpson says it was his connection to these crime figures. And folks, that's a little troubling, isn't it? Little troubling. That might be one reason why old Chuck Grassley had a death grip on these things. There's others. And one of the things that he goes into here is, back in the day, we're talking like 2009 through 2012, there was a bank in Kazakhstan called BTA Bank. The bank was headquartered in a city called Almaty, and in 2013 it was the largest lender of assets and was also subject to one of the world's biggest financial frauds. Did you know that? I mean, it kind of snuck under the radar. I guess I didn't hear it back then, but the fraud of that bank totaled $5 billion, and the fraud was alleged to have been perpetrated by Mukhtar Ablyazov, the bank's former chairman. And according to an article by Bloomberg, and I put a link in my show notes, as the failed bank was trying to recover these assets like mines, they had hotels, shopping centers, and they were spread across the former Soviet bloc. While they were trying to do that, Ablyazov and his family were busy squirreling away hundreds of millions into properties in Europe and other U.S. cities, including 3 condos and a luxury Manhattan development known as Trump Soho. So we're getting this picture that the bank failure In the money that was defrauded from this bank, some of it was finding homes in across Europe as well as the United States, and some of that evidently allegedly ended up in Trump's Soho. And at this stage, we're not connecting Donald Trump to that, obviously, but he's just saying that the money did flow and it went into real estate, and some of that was the Trump Soho project. And in November, I think you probably saw the news that Donald Trump divested of the licensing agreement that they had with Soho when they took the name off of the building. So it no longer is a branded Trump property. So the interesting part here is this man, Felix Sater, had some connections with Donald Trump. And, you know, they're saying here, they learned that, according to the testimony, Glenn Simpson is saying, we learned that Felix Sater had some connections with these people, the ones that evidently, he's saying, did the defrauding. And it's been more recently in the media that he's helping the government of Kazakhstan to recover some of the money. There's been media reports that the money went up into the Trump Soho, or it went into the company that built the Trump Soho. So there's some interesting money flows that Glenn Simpson's alluding to that came from Kazakhstan and possibly into some of these projects like Trump Soho. And again, they're not connecting Donald Trump to any wrongdoing at this stage. They're just saying the money did flow, which is interesting. So another part of this transcript kind of deals with how Russia moves money in and out of the United States. And one of the ways they do that is through the Russian pension system, which I think Glenn Simpson was sort of surprised at that as well. And the sanctions that we put in place, I believe mostly under the Obama administration, of course, really crimp the way that Russia can move money in and out of the United States. And I quote Glenn Simpson here, and he says that basically, because everyone in Russia, you know, more or less works for the government, there's a large number of Russian emigres in the United States who receive pension payments that are all paid through the embassies and various people. Russian lawyers and others who became interested in the course of this investigation seem to be involved in that process. And I'm quoting Glenn Simpson again. He says, I'm not saying they did anything illegal. I'm just saying, you know, we looked at this system. And as someone who does a lot of money laundering work, this was an interesting thing that I hadn't heard about. There's all this money flowing in the United States from Russia. It probably flows in under some sort of diplomatic status. So if there's sanctions on Russia and the Russians can't move money in the United States for most things, this would in fact be an ideal mechanism for moving money into the United States for whatever purpose, for some kind of illicit purpose. So that's an interesting little sidebar of that transcript. So that's where the lawyer that was in Sunny Isles, Florida, comes into play. And evidently, this lawyer had some expertise in these matters. And Glenn is saying that somehow this lawyer would help the flows of some of those funds, whatever that means. But we're continuing to go through those, but that's some of the stuff that is in those transcripts. And it's interesting information. And folks, you know about that dossier that Fusion GPS did. Here's the deal. You kind of know this, but the Republicans have been trying to show that the Russian dossier is false because they thought that was the reason the FBI started this whole investigation. Well, as we know now, the Australian diplomat that tipped off the FBI back in June of 2016 about George Papadopoulos having said the Russians had thousands of emails from the DNC was the real reason, wasn't it? The FBI kicked off the investigation. But the Republicans, as we can tell, are still trying to discredit the Steele dossier, even to the point where Senators Grassley and Lindsey Graham have made a criminal referral from the Senate Judicial Committee back to the Department of Justice and the FBI. So the important thing to remember about that referral that they've made here, it's just posturing. And it's important to note that anybody can make a criminal referral to the Justice Department at the FBI, and you know, neither body there is really under any obligation to act on the referral. Anybody can do it. So what they were trying to do is they're trying to hint in their referral letter that Christopher Steele lied to FBI agents about his contacts with reporters when he spoke with the Bureau during the campaign about his reports. He might have got a date wrong. I don't know. They're trying to make a big deal out of it. But again, it's more or less political posturing. So as those things go on, we'll keep you appraised of the transcripts. But the next story I'm going to tell you about here is the Russians are still hacking. And this one comes to us from Business Insider on January 6th. And I've got a link out in the show notes. And this is interesting because I'm going to tell you, just sort of scanning from the article here, it says, the U.S. has seen initial signs of Russian subversion and disinformation and propaganda in Mexico's presidential campaign. And that's according to National Security Advisor General H.R. McMaster. So he made these comments during a mid-December event at the Jamestown Foundation in Washington. And, you know, there's some other things that he said here. Namely, he also went into the Catalonia independence referendum in Spain. Remember that? And McMaster said, you see this most recently with the Catalonia independence referendum. You actually see initial signs of it in the Mexican presidential campaign already. So this is scary stuff. They're still hacking out there. And, you know, by the way, folks, it's rumored that McMaster, one of the people that I call a Trump firewall, as I like to put it, is going to be possibly leaving the White House. So do you think that this information and McMaster's sort of acknowledgement that the U.S. is seeing signs of further hacking globally by Russia, do you think that's got something to do with his leaving? I can't wait to find out. But I'm telling you, I think it does. I think they're kind of getting rid of the guy. And it's a shame because he is one of the Trump firewalls. And do we have enough of these firewalls in place? No. We need more people like that can go out and actually say things like this and not try to hide it. Shouldn't be trying to hide it. For God's sakes, we need to fix it. We need to do something about it. And like I've said, we need to put money into our electronic walls as opposed to, you know, this wall that Donald Trump's talking about, is Great Wall of America, for God's sakes. We need electronic wall because, look, stuff like this, the hacking is continuing. And it's invisible, you can't see it, but it's going on. And McMaster's talking about it, and here he goes. He's probably going to be leaving as a result. I don't know. I think probably of his opinions of this, how he feels about the Russia hacking and their ongoing involvement. So as you know, Paul Manafort is Trump's former campaign advisor. He's suing the Department of Justice, and he's basically, this whole thing is amounting to a legal strategy that's designed to get Mueller to describe the scope of the whole investigation instead of him having an open mandate. They're trying to limit the scope, and here's one way that they're trying to do that. And nobody thinks that it's going to go anywhere, but we're going to watch it. So folks, did you happen to see the State of the Union last Sunday with Jake Tapper? My God. Oh. What a gut-wrenching interview that was. And White House advisor Stephen Miller, who I like to call Pee Wee Herman. You've seen him, right? Monotone, little eyes, you know. Sort of a Pee Wee Herman kind of like guy. This White House advisor, Stephen Miller, was basically cut short for what I would say was trying to use CNN as a pulpit for Trump propaganda. And folks, it basically sounded like Stephen Miller was speaking to Trump in a genuflecting tone. Genuflecting tone, at which point Jake had enough, and he basically said he was speaking just to Trump through CNN, and that's not what CNN's listeners wanted to hear. Nobody wants to hear that genuflecting tone. And what happened here that's kind of interesting, it's kind of creepy actually, but I think Stephen Miller's creepy. But what actually happened here He was escorted off the set of CNN's State of the Union on Sunday after a contentious interview with Jake Tapper. And two sources close to the situation told Business Insider, who I'm getting this from, that after taping was done, Stephen Miller was politely asked to leave several times. Stephen ignored those requests, and ultimately security was called, and he was escorted out. Get him out of here. Don't come around here no more. CNN has declined to comment on the story. And Business Insider kind of goes on to say Miller's appearance on the cable network quickly went off the rails when Tapper pressed him on explosive claims about President Donald Trump that appeared in the book Fire and Fury. Wow. And folks, have you ever noticed that Trump's people do a lot of genuflecting? And when I say genuflecting, I mean to say that that's the gentle bend of the knee before the king or the queen. And I do have a lot of respect for the queen, and I enjoy just the thing about Britain and the queen. I have a lot of respect for that institution, but she has a lot more class than our Donald Trump, who I think is trying to be king. It's almost a tawdry sort of version of a king, isn't it? But getting back to genuflecting, I mean, that's what it is. It's the gentle bend of the knee before the king and the queen. And you know who's best at it? Mike Pence. Oh, gag. He's the best at doing this verbally, as are many of Trump's cabinet members. I mean, how many times have we seen the camera go around to each individual cabinet member and verbal genuflecting is, makes you want to gag. And Orrin Hatch, the senator of... what is it, Arizona, that's retiring right now? No, is it Utah? Sorry, it's Utah. So Senator Orrin Hatch, he did this in the press opportunity after passing the tax bill that just went through. And he did it by saying, Trump may be the best president ever. Oh, Lord, please, come on. I was so embarrassed for Orrin Hatch when he said that. The genuflecting. I mean, it just makes me want to gag. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, it just makes me ill. And I'm sitting here trying to tolerate Trump as president. You know this. And the verbal genuflecting, it just makes me ill. Gag. Oh, Lord. Well, anyway, we're moving on to the next story here, which is Kushner's financial ties to Israel deepen even with Mideast diplomatic role. And I've got a link in my show notes that you can click on and check this out. But last May, as you know, and I'm going into the article details here. And again, check out the show notes for the full article. But last May, Jared Kushner accompanied President Trump, his father-in-law, on the pair's first diplomatic trip to Israel. Part of his assignment by the White House to achieve peace in the Middle East. Good luck with that, Jared. And... shortly before, his family real estate company received roughly $30 million of an investment from Menorah Mivtachim. Menorah Mivtachim, I guess is how you say it. Sorry to learn how to pronounce it on the air, but I have difficulty with Russian and Israeli pronunciations. But this company, Menorah Mivtachim, was an insurer that is one of Israel's largest financial institutions, according to one of their executives. The deal, which was not made public, pumped a lot of new money into 10 Maryland apartment complexes controlled by Mr. Kushner's firm. And while Kushner has sold parts of his business since taking a White House job last year, he still has stakes in most of the family empire, including those apartment buildings in and around Baltimore. So folks, you think this administration is a step in the right direction, a breath of fresh air, challenging the way things were done before? Well, here's a story at how this administration, and specifically Jared Kushner, is prospering from the office. You just can't keep him away from the money, can you? You just can't do it. Grab, grab, grab. It seems so transparent and out in the open. Just money, 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 grab, grab, grab. It's always about the money with this administration, folks. The little guy is just a stepping stone. I'm here to tell you, sorry. The little guy is just a stepping stone. Check out the link on my show notes for more. And... how Jared prospered from that deal, and you be the judge on whether you think that's right or wrong. We're just letting you know about it. You know what I think. But this whole book, you know, this whole book that just came out, the Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury. Wow. Oh, my God. I have to say that there's a lot of stuff in there that's a good read, but it doesn't seem to impact the Mueller investigation so much. There's a little bit that might, but most of it is just an interesting read on the president, isn't it? Wow. And more we learn, the more we're confirmed that, the more that we're confirming that, you know, Trump, I think he's got issues, right? So this book, I've got a link on my show notes again to the article from Hollywood Reporter, and you can feel free to click on that. The stories are salacious. The evidence seemed to suggest the presidency of chaos and anarchy that ends in our questioning of his mental stability as president, doesn't it? I mean, it just contributes to that. And a big contributor of this book seems to be Steve Bannon, and I'm calling what he did in providing information to Michael Wolff the Bannon hedge. It's a hedge, folks. And more on that in a second. So the book just goes into a whole litany of things here, and you've heard about some of those. I won't go into some of those, but one of the interesting things, and Lawrence O'Donnell, and this was actually on Monday night's Lawrence O'Donnell show, it was kind of interesting, folks, that Michael Wolff actually attributes Hope Hicks as one of Mr. Trump's central advisors. He called her one of his central advisors. And what in the hell do we know about 29-year-old Hope Hicks, who has the president's ear? Not that she's good or bad. The point is, we just don't know. It's endless. It's endless, folks. The next thing we're waiting on here is a Rasputin-like figure to emerge at the White House. But, you know, with Hope Hicks, it was Hope Hicks who, according to Michael Wolff, attentive to his lapses and repetitions, urged Trump to forego an interview that was set to open on 60 Minutes in the fall season. Instead, the interview went to Fox News' Sean Hannity, of course, who the White House insiders happily explained was willing to supply the questions beforehand. And it's just interesting how it works. So Hope Hicks kind of directed him towards Sean Hannity because they would give them the questions that they were going to ask beforehand, and it's sort of how they like to work with the media. They love Fox News because they pander to Donald Trump. And you talk about fake news, folks. I mean, you talk about fake news. Try and help me understand how Fox News isn't heavily engaged in protecting Donald Trump when they're supplying questions before an interview like this. And we've seen Sean Hannity genuflect to Donald Trump. And this whole thing, though, with Michael Wolff, getting back to that, Trump's tendency to repeat and repeat himself, the thing here, folks, it just really gives us some insight into what kind of chaos is going on in this presidency. And one of the things that I really find interesting is the way that evidently Donald Trump just repeats, repeats, and repeats. You know, they would keep track of it. Every hour he would repeat something X number of times, and then it became every 30 minutes, and then it became, I mean, what's going on here? Come on, Trump. I mean, put it all together. I mean, get a grip. But folks, I'm glad to say that we've brought back Elmer Fudd to read a Trump tweet here from January 6th, and we're going to kick it off. Elmer, go ahead and tell us.
Actually, throughout my life, my two greatest assets have been mental stability and being, like, really smart. Crooked Hillary Lee Clinton also played these cards very hard, and as everyone knows, went down in flames. I went from very successful businessman to top TV star to president of the United States on my first try. I think that would qualify as not smart, but genius, and a very, very stable genius at that.
Well, that's a nice deflection there in that tweet from Donald Trump to Hillary Clinton, which, by the way, is in itself getting repetitive and tiresome. Aren't you tired of it? The deflection, the constant deflection to Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary is, she's out of it. She's been gone. The election's been over. She's probably reading a good book somewhere with a cup of coffee, enjoying herself. I mean, the constant deflection to Hillary, it's becoming a sort of reminder that things may not be quite right upstairs with Donald Trump. But to try and say that the mental stability card was played hard by Hillary and didn't work well, I got to tell you, she didn't have the information that we now have from this new book. Shouldn't that be apparent to Trump? I mean, you see, the whole argument in that tweet is ludicrous, and I'm not the only one that sees it that way, for God's sakes. But before we move on from this whole debacle that this book brings and how it fuels the mental instability questions, with ample reason, in my opinion, to do so, why do you think that Steve Bannon, why do you think Steve said as much as he did? And nobody's quite cracked the code on this, Steve Bannon, but, you know, he's quite an enigma, and stupid he is not. Tactful, strategic, he is. But why do you think Steve Bannon said as much as he did? And have you noticed in trying to walk all of this back that Steve Bannon really stopped short of apologizing, didn't he? He's expressed regret, yes he has, but that's not really an apology. And here's the deal, folks. In my humble opinion, Steve Bannon has just set up a see, I told you so kind of moment, an insurance policy, or the Bannon hedge, if you will. Steve Bannon, as I expect trouble for Trump, bases the Mueller investigation as far as obstruction of justice and collusion are concerned. That's one thing we agree on, that there's an iceberg dead ahead. And as this wears on throughout this year, 2018, rather than have Trump's falling star affect Steve Bannon's vision for America, Steve Bannon can now step back and say, see, I told you so, when it happens. When the dam breaks, at this stage, folks, Steve Bannon's going to pop out. He's going to emerge as the new standard bearer for his vision of America, the alt-right. And in Steve's opinion, the donors will then fall back in line behind him. So Steve has sort of set this hedge up, and I don't think he's anticipated the impact of it with him having to leave Breitbart and all of that. But he said what he said. He's not really apologized for it, folks, and it's a hedge. When things get difficult for Donald Trump, you're going to see Bannon come back out of the woodwork, and he's going to point to it, and he's going to say 1,000 times, see, I told you so. And he's going to try to set himself up as the new messiah for his vision of America. And just wait and see. Just wait and see. He's not gone yet. He's not gone yet. He's not quite gone. But the one thing that Michael Wolff did mention in this book, I'm going to wrap that up with the statement. Insiders are quoted to have believed that the only thing saving Mueller from being fired in the government of the United States from unfathomable implosion is Trump's inability to grasp how much Mueller had on him and his family. Well, that just begs the question that as that becomes apparent, doesn't it? Once Trump does get the grasp of how much Mueller has on him and his family, what the hell is going to happen next? And bringing clarity to that statement brings us to the Mueller request just in the past few days for an interview with Donald Trump to take place over the next few weeks. So how do you think, I think that's going to help Trump's inability to grasp what is going on with this Mueller investigation. And it's just going to get crazier and crazier with Donald Trump, folks. I got to tell you. And it's sort of scary because I really can't even predict what he's going to do next. And, we're moving on to this story. And good Lord, tell me this isn't true, folks. Please, somebody tell me this isn't true. 85-year-old Joe Arpaio of Arizona is running for state senate. I mean, whoa. Hold on. I mean, pardon me. Shouldn't he be out in the woodshed playing with a scroll saw or something like that, or working on jigsaw puzzles. I mean, go away, Joe. Go. Just go. Just go away. Please. And while I'm on a roll here, folks, this is just in from Alex Jones. And, you know, I'm no fan of Alex Jones. I'm not. I can't stand the guy. He's a charlatan. He's a snake oil salesman. You know, he's nuts. And what he just said this week is that Oprah Winfrey met in secret with George Soros and other billionaires to discuss a plan to depopulate the world. He's a nut job. Alex Jones, you are a nut job. They should pull your plug for crap like this. But, God, anyway. But interesting thing is, and I'm kind of going on a little bit longer than usual here, but I've just got a little bit more I want to blab out here. And thank you for bearing with me. But, you know, Californians, I have to say, they've got a good reason not to like Donald Trump, according to the New York Times. And when you think about it, just listen to this story. New York Times brings this to us. And just as Californians were enjoying their first days of legal pot smoking, the Trump administration moved to enforce federal laws against the drug. So you've got states' rights being trampled on by federal rights. And I always thought that states' rights were paramount, but they're paramount to the Trump administration when it works for them. Otherwise, they don't give a damn. On that same day, the federal government said it would expand offshore oil drilling, which actually Florida got a little bit of a pardon on that, didn't they? How does that work, Mr. Trump? I mean, what does California have to do to get a pardon on the oil drilling? Is this punishment for being a Democratic state? I mean, it's an assault on their pristine coastline, for God's sakes. And the article goes on to say that when President Trump signed a law that would raise the tax bills of many Californians by restricting deductions, lawmakers in California proposed a creative workaround, essentially making the taxes charitable contributions and fully deductible. And you've got California's refusal to help federal agents deport undocumented immigrants, prompting one administration official to say that they should be arrested. So this clash between California and Trump and his supporters, it's between one America and another, and it began the morning after he won the presidency, according to the article, and Kevin DeLeon, who's a state Senate leader, and his counterpart in the Assembly, Anthony Rendon, said they woke up one morning and they thought they were in a foreign land, for God's sakes. And one thing that California is doing is they've got a new law that went into effect on January 1st, and that effectively raised the minimum wage. Good for you. It needs to happen all over the United States, for God's sakes. And as I mentioned in one of my previous podcasts, the basis, federal mandated minimum wage that some states subscribe to, a lot of them, is $7.25 an hour. So some of the other things that they're doing here, they've got some of the toughest gun laws in the country by restricting ammunition sales and assault weapons. And they're barring school officials from carrying concealed weapons at work. And taken together, the article indicates the measures are the surest signs yet of how California is setting itself apart from Washington. And they're setting themselves from parts of America, too. So, the thing that's crazy about this whole thing, folks, is that the article goes on to say here, for his part, Trump is the first president since Dwight D. Eisenhower not to take a trip to California in his first calendar year. He doesn't even visit his golf course in Rancho Palos Verdes, or just south of Los Angeles. And he's got a mansion in Beverly Hills that he's not even gone to. I bet the staff is happier than hell about that. The point is here that he's not even been to California to tour the vast damage that was left in the wake of a series of wildfires, devastating wildfires. And we've just had, 13 people that have died in some of these, the flooding and the mud and the houses coming down. 13 people have died in Southern California just this week. Sad, sad. Do you think he could see it to say something? Do you think he could even say something about it? No. He's made multiple trips to other states hit by disasters, including Texas and Florida, but he can't go to California. Doesn't even say anything about it. I mean, that's a travesty. If he intends to be a president to all the people, he's going to have to start being a president to all the people. And folks, there's something genuinely American about California. something we may have lost or it's subdued in other states. But there's something genuinely American about it. It's that American desire to generally welcome people to become Americans from all places and not look to build fences but build bridges. And that's what the Californians are doing, and push back they will when a tax cut for the rich, push back on states' rights to deduct state and local income taxes and property taxes. Push back they will. Good for them. You know, these Californians, they're welcoming but feisty, which is what I like about Californians. Keep it up. So it's kind of interesting here. You know, just briefly, we've had Trump come out and say that now all of a sudden he's kind of glad that North Korea is sort of defusing the situation. But then he kind of muddies the water by saying that, by talking about this bloody nose strategy, you know, with North Korea. I mean, is it possible? On one hand, he's saying it's a good thing that talks are happening between North and South Korea, and they're evidently looking to, North and South Korea are actively looking to cooperate. The successful hosting of the Pyongyang Olympics, so that it serves as an occasion to raise the status of the Korean people. In a news release, they're saying North Korea will send the People's Olympic Committee delegation, athletes, a cheering squad, an art troupe, a visitors group, a taekwondo demonstration team, and a press corps. And South Korea is going to provide the necessary hospitality. But, folks, in my view, anything that de-escalates this threat of nuclear action is a good thing. And to Donald Trump's credit, he has come out and said that talks are a good thing. So, on one hand, he says that, which I think is good. But then on the other hand, we're hearing reports of a little bit of talk in his administration about a bloody nose strategy. How can they go in and give North Korea a bloody nose militarily? How can they make a strategic hit on their border without igniting a war? Well, you can't. I mean, for God's sakes, no, you can't. And you know, folks, I kind of wonder, my fear is sort of that Donald Trump will do something stupid like this bloody nose strategy, and all of a sudden they're lobbing missiles into South Korea, into Seoul, which is 35 miles away. I mean, why even? I can't imagine talking about a bloody nose strategy in a strategic hit on North Korea. I mean, it's just ridiculous. On one hand, he's saying talks are a good thing, and then they spin around in their chair, swivel chair, and they're talking about a bloody nose strategy. I don't get it. I'm worried about it. And like I said, I'm at this point, I'm worried more of what Donald Trump will do than what Kim Jong will do. For God's sakes. So we've got our president getting his first physical coming up on Friday. But you're not going to probably find out much about it, our 70-year-old chief executive. And I can't wait to get to the report, but I'll bet you a bucket of KFC that we won't get the kind of details that we've received in the past about presidential checkups. He's so vain. Trump is so vain. He won't allow one shred of evidence that may even suggest he's anything but as fit as a 20-year-old. And if Trump was smart here, he'd punt on the medical side and not release the information, but distract everyone and have a mental exam by a doctor of his choice that comes in and comes out on TV and says, yep, he's as fit as a fiddle mentally. There ain't nothing wrong with him. And if he was smart, he would have a doctor come out and say that. But we're probably not going to hear anything about this. It's that crazy talk that makes the world wonder, isn't it? When you said... Like just yesterday when Trump said, or the day before, when Trump said to the Tennesseans who voted for him, he was in Tennessee, and he said, you are so lucky that I gave you that privilege to vote for me. I mean, come on, that's crazy talk. That's nuts. Get a mental exam. Let us know how it goes. You know, having said that, though, I have to admit here, folks, that it might be fun for a day to go Trump style. You know, you've heard of Gangnam Style and all that. It might be fun for a day, wouldn't it, to just sit in a big bed with three TVs tuned to my favorite news shows. None of those would be Fox, of course. And then have somebody bring malts and cheeseburgers into me, just once, Trump style. That sounds like fun. So, interesting thing here, folks, is climate change is real, you say. And the PRISM Climate Group, based out of Oregon State University, they have just said that 2017 finished out about 1.3 degrees above the past 30-year average for temperatures, just out. And I just have to say, Donald Trump, are you listening to that? And this is no time to plead ignorance about climate change every time we happen to get snow. He says something about climate change. Well, it doesn't look like it's getting any warmer. We're getting a little more snow today. Oh, shut up. I mean, it really gets old when you're confronted with evidence like the kind we just got from Oregon State University. Over the past 30 years, the temperatures are going up. Last year, 1.3 degrees. So one of the things that we're hearing is that this climate change, it's even going to start affecting our beloved chocolate. And I'm going back to the Business Insider again. They've got a referral to an article that shows a 2014 study by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change indicating that under a business-as-usual scenario, the world's leading chocolate producers in Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana might experience a 3.8 Fahrenheit increase in temperature by 2050 and may no longer be able to cultivate cocoa. So they're saying that this won't lead to the point of extinction, but it's certainly going to make the prices go up. And because we've got a president that's ignorant to climate change, we can bank on cocoa prices ramping higher and higher, probably getting exponential as climate change worsens. Thanks, Donald. Thank you, Donald Trump. Yep, now you're affecting our cocoa, our beloved chocolate. You know, one thing we can do here, folks, with all of the crazy talk of Donald Trump, you know, there is a place that you can go to and simultaneously escape all of the stress of the Trump administration. And that is to take a trip to Angelina Cafes in Paris. Angelina Cafes. Where you can get some decadently rich cocoa, complete with a separate small cup of whipped cream. While sitting there, you can experience some tableside theater as the waiter lifts the jug of cocoa higher and higher to send a cascading stream of chocolate down into your cup. And you can enjoy all of this in a Belle Epoque-style tea room at 226 Rue de Rivoli. And when you're done, you can walk around a little bit and enjoy the beautiful surrounding gardens. You may even just forget who Trump is after all of that, which is highly therapeutic, isn't it? And there's no better time in April, my friends, just like the song says. April in Paris. And with all of that, I want to thank you for the listen. And as always, we're going to see you the next time here, just around the corner, which might be very shortly. Don't forget to tell your friends about therustedculture.com, and that'll get them here every time. We're going to let Doris Day take us away. April in Paris, a little cup of cocoa, some whipped cream, maybe a little croissant. That's the way to escape the sheer madness of Donald Trump. Folks, we'll see you next time. Embrace till April.